Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed welcomes Dr. Harriet Kluger. Dr. Kluger is an associate professor of medical oncology at Yale School of Medicine, and she's an expert in the treatment of kidney cancer.
Why don't we start off with a brief overview of kidney cancer? Maybe you can tell us, how significant is kidney cancer in terms of public health problem?
So it's one of the more common kinds of cancer. There are 57,000 new diagnoses in the United States each year. There are around 11,500 deaths each year. Now, the incidence of kidney cancer has actually gone up, but it might just be because we're getting better at diagnosing them and picking them up earlier, and that these cases actually were there and went along undetected over many years before we started using CAT scans that frequently.
It's interesting because I have to say I don't think of kidney cancer as a common disease, but when you say that it's 57,000 or whatever, that's pretty significant.
That's right. So just to give you a reference point, the incidence of breast cancer is 220,000. So it's about a quarter of about a quarter of the incidence of the more common diseases.
Mm-hmm. And in what age group does kidney cancer typically develop?
So it peaks in the 6th and 7th decades. So in other words, people in the 50s and 60s. Sometimes we see younger, we see older. That's just the average incidence.
And what do we know in terms of the risk factors?
A number of risk factors have been established. Smoking, obesity, high blood pressure, acquired cystic disease, and a number of other chronic kidney ailments predispose people to getting kidney cancer. Certainly patients who are immunosuppressed are more likely to get it, such as kidney transplant patients or other organ transplant recipients who are on chronic immunosuppression.
And what do we know about, say, the genetics? Is there a familial predisposition if, say, a family member has developed kidney cancer?
Yes, there can be. Most of the cases are what we call sporadic, in other words, isolated incidences. But there are a number of genetic syndromes that have been identified over the past years. The most common one is called von Hippel-Landau syndrome, which is basically a problem with the formation of blood vessels. And in those patients, we see a higher incidence of kidney cancer. There are a number of other hereditary syndromes that have been identified as well.
And so say, rarer. For instance, in this von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, would the kidney cancer develop at an earlier age or also develop in the 60s and 70s?
No, it tends to develop earlier on, and they tend to have multiple kidney cancers.
Mm-hmm. And is kidney cancer just one disease, or are there kind of different subtypes within that big diagnosis?
So there are a number of different subtypes. The most common type is called renal cell carcinoma. That type arrives from the cells of the kidney that are responsible for draining our fluids, getting rid of toxins that we drink, getting rid of extra salts, and so on. But there are other cells within the kidney, and cancer can certainly arise in those cells as well. We can have transitional cell carcinoma of the kidney, which is more like a bladder cancer. It arises from a different part of the kidney. You can have tumors of the blood vessels within the kidneys and so on. But those are much rarer. The renal cell carcinomas comprise about 90% of all of the kidney cancers, and the other group is around 10%.
Mm-hmm. And do kidney cancers typically just reside within the kidneys, or can they spread off into other parts of the body?
No, they can spread off into other parts of the body as well, and that, of course, relates to the likelihood of survival. So we use what we call a staging system. It's used in many cancers. You can have stage 1 to stage 4 kidney cancer. So just in general terms, stage 1 would be a smaller cancer up to 7 centimeters in size that's confined to the kidney. Stage 2 would be over 7 centimeters but still confined to the kidney. Stage 3 would be a kidney cancer that's invading adjacent structures like the adrenal gland, which sits just above the kidney. It can invade into the tissues around the kidney or into a single lymph node. And that, of course, is associated with a slightly worse prognosis. And then stage four kidney cancer is cancer that's either spread to more lymph nodes or spread beyond the tissues that surround the kidney or to even distant organs such as the bones and the lungs and so on.
Now, for a lot of different cancers, such as colon cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, and prostate cancer, we've got screening and early detection methods that have been developed. Is there any such screening or early detection methodology that's been developed for kidney cancer?
Well, it's not being used because it's probably not as common as the diseases that you just mentioned. So in patients that have a very strong family history of kidney cancer, you can look at urine cytology and see if you can see cancer cells spilled into the urine, or you could do screening ultrasounds, and sometimes cases are picked up in that fashion, but it's only done when there's a very strong family history of it or when a patient has a known genetic abnormality such as the von Hippel-Landau syndrome that we talked about earlier. But at this point, there's no standard screening method.
So for an average risk individual, which would be the vast majority of people who are probably listening this evening, there really is nothing that we can recommend as of 2009.
That's correct. Even patients who have the risk factors that I mentioned, like hypertension, obesity, and so on, there's nothing that is done at this point.
And what are the symptoms, Harriet, that are typically associated with an underlying kidney cancer?
So there is what we call the classic triad of symptoms. It's pain in the flank, blood in the urine, and a palpable mass. Now, in the old days, most patients actually presented with at least two of the three classic symptoms. Nowadays, with increased use of all sorts of imaging for other purposes, more and more patients are having their diagnosis made incidentally. The people got a CAT scan for something else, or an ultrasound for something else, and the kidney cancer was seen.
Now, palpable mass, is that a mass that the individual, him or herself, can feel, or is that a mass that only the physician could probably feel?
Well, if they're really big, the patient can feel them, but because mm-hmm. the kidney is sort of at the back of the abdomen, it has to be really big for a patient to notice it, in essence.
So I guess the main symptoms that might have someone go seek further attention would be pain, difficulty urinating, blood in the urine. And flank discomfort.
Correct.
And then if those symptoms should occur, what should an individual do? Who should they see first in terms of medical attention?
Well, typically people will go to see their primary care physician first, and the primary care physician would probably order an ultrasound to work up the pain.
And ultrasound comes back and it shows a suspicious mass in one of the kidneys. What would be done next?
So it's interesting. In most other diseases, if there's a mass or a tumor somewhere in an organ, we go ahead and biopsy it. Kidney cancer, for the most part, we don't do that. And that might be because of old dogma. There were incidences in the past where patients had a biopsy, and then there was tracking of tumor cells along the biopsy area. And that's why it's not done in kidney cancer. But in fact, it's probably a rare side effect of biopsies, but the standard of care has not changed. The radiologists are pretty good at defining cancer versus non-cancer based on the appearance of an X-ray or a CAT scan, more so than with many other diseases. And so if it's suspicious, it gets taken out rather than biopsied for the most part.
And so taken out by a surgeon, or who would be the one to take out that kidney tumor?
So the patient would then be referred to a urologist. There are a number of urologists at Yale who specialize in kidney cancer. The tumor can be removed laparoscopically if it's not too big, and that is a real breakthrough in the surgical approach, because patients recover from these laparoscopic surgeries so much quicker than they do from open surgeries, even if the cut is relatively big, because if you're taking out an 8 or 10 centimeter mass, it has to come through somewhere, so the cut in the skin may be big, but the recovery is still very, very quick. They're up within days and walking around and feeling much better very quickly. So laparoscopic surgery, when feasible, when the mass isn't too big and not invading adjacent structures, that's probably a good way to go. Otherwise, open surgery for removal is another way. If a patient has kidney disease, for example, if they've got some cystic kidney disease and the rest of the kidney isn't functioning all that well, you may not want to, and especially if it's a small tumor, you may not want to remove the whole kidney. So you can do what we call a partial nephrectomy, so removal of part of the kidney. And that's typically done with open surgery. There are other methods. If a patient is very old and not a candidate for surgery, you can have radiofrequency ablation or cryoablation. That's when you freeze the tumors. And those appear to be fairly effective in certain individuals.
Now, I would guess also in determining whether or not a patient could undergo surgical resection of that tumor, one would want to make sure that the kidney cancer hasn't spread beyond the local confines of the kidney.
Yes, so patients typically have a CAT scan of the abdomen and pelvis and a chest X-ray. We'll sometimes order a chest CAT scan as well. Now, on occasion, even if the cancer has spread beyond the confines of the kidney, we still remove the kidney. And again, that's a little different than the paradigm that we use to treat most cancers. Mm-hmm. So there are a few patients who have what we call spontaneous regression of metastases. So if a patient has cancer that's spread to the lungs as well, and you remove the kidney tumors, there's a certain percentage of patients whose lung tumors will actually shrink when you remove the original tumor from the kidney. We used to think that that's because of immune reaction, so you're activating the immune system, or you're removing something that suppresses the immune system in the kidney. But there's another possibility. The tumors in the kidney create a lot of hormones that make blood vessels in tumors, and when you remove the source of those hormones, you might actually be removing what makes the blood tumors grow in the tumors in the lungs and what makes those tumors thrive. So if we have a patient who can handle the surgery and in whom the bulk of the disease is in the kidney, even if it's spread beyond the area of the kidney, we will still remove the kidney. And that has been shown to be associated with improved survival as well, rather than leaving it in.
Great. Terrific. And once surgery has been done, is there any role for any additional therapy?
If the patient has metastatic disease, so disease that's spread, yes, we definitely try to treat those tumors, and we can talk about that a little further because we have a lot of options there. Mm-hmm. If there's no visible tumors left after we've removed the kidney, then the question is, should we give what we call adjuvant therapy, adjuvant meaning boosting? And why do you do that? Because there's a possibility that very, very small foci of tumors have already escaped from the area of the kidney, and over time they can grow. So adjuvant therapy is given in other diseases like breast cancer and colon cancer. After you've removed the tumor, you go ahead and give some additional chemotherapy. So currently we have a very big clinical trial looking at the role of adjuvant therapy in kidney cancer. There are two drugs that have been shown to be effective in metastatic kidney cancer, so patients can get either one of the two drugs or observation. And hopefully we'll have the answer to that over the next 4 or 5 years.
And maybe, Harry, you can tell us what are those two drugs that are being tested in the adjuvant setting?
Well, they've got lovely names. One is called sorafenib, and the other one's called sunitinib. They are actually fairly similar. They target this whole blood vessel factory within the kidney tumors. Again, the thought is that if you give it for a year after resection of a primary tumor, maybe we'll be starving tiny metastatic foci of their blood supply and not enabling them to grow.
Now, is there any role for radiation therapy to be given after a surgery has been performed?
Not in this disease. The kidney cancer cells themselves are very resistant to radiation therapy, and we tend not to use it. We certainly don't use it as adjuvant therapy, so in other words, to sterilize the area after a cancer has been removed. We do use it down the road if a patient develops metastatic disease, it's spread to other organs, and we need to do it to control pain in the bones and so on, particularly if these are areas that can tolerate high levels of radiation that are required to kill the kidney cancer cells.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, you're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here this evening discussing kidney cancer detection and treatment with Dr. Harriet Kluger from the Yale Cancer Center.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing cancer treatment is very exciting, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Ed Chu, and I'm here in the studio this evening with my guest expert, Dr. Harry Kluger, Associate Professor of Medicine and Medical Oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. And before the break, we were talking about the surgical approach to kidney cancer. Maybe we can take a step back and talk about the multidisciplinary approach to treating patients with kidney cancer. And what is the approach that you and your colleagues at the Yale Cancer Center are taking, Harriet?
So we have a group of physicians that meets every other week to discuss cases. The group includes people from multiple disciplines. So we mentioned earlier that sometimes the radiologists can always tell us whether a tumor is suspicious or not. So we have an excellent radiologist, Dr. Gary Israel, who's an integral part of the group, and he's excellent at reading these kidney masses and assisting us in deciding whether we should go for surgery or not. Then we have two dedicated pathologists, Dr. Kenneth Haynes and Dr. Demetrius Braddock, who help us with doing the molecular subtyping as well as the histologic subtyping, and we'll explain in a minute exactly what that is. There are three surgeons who do surgery for kidney cancer. Dinesh Singh is the laparoscopic expert. John Kohlberg does all of the open surgeries, and Dr. Ed Uccio actually does both of them. And there are three medical oncologists, Dr. Schnoll, Dr. Kelly, and myself. We all get together to discuss cases because sometimes it's not clear whether we should try to do systemic therapy, in other words, therapy by pill or by IV first to shrink a tumor in order to make it more feasible to resect that tumor, especially if it's a complicated case, or whether the patient's a candidate for surgery. There are all sorts of issues that need to be discussed at this multidisciplinary tumor board. And that's really where a lot of the action happens in terms of the decision making. It's very difficult to get five people to give input by telephone at different times, but this forum really enables us to have an open discussion about individual cases that are complicated.
Now, would you typically see the patient together in a multidisciplinary clinic? Or are there plans to do so?
Yes, there are, and we do sometimes do that. If a patient goes into the surgery clinic who needs to see a medical oncologist, often they'll just page us and we go upstairs to see the patient with the surgeon. Sometimes we do that in a more formal fashion. We have a multidisciplinary clinic on a Thursday morning, in which we see patients together with the surgeons. And going into the Smilo Center, we will be sharing space with the urologic surgeons, and we can discuss the patients while they're there.
And I think that would be obviously great for the patients, so that they don't obviously have to kind of go from clinic to different office.
Yes, it makes it much easier for the patient. It all happens in one setting, although I must admit that it's often a long session for the patient. When they see three or four doctors, sometimes they have to be there for a few hours.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking about how obviously surgery is the preferred approach for, say, someone who's got more locally confined disease. But are there any? Would there be any cases in which maybe surgery might not be indicated because of individual patient characteristics?
Yes, so sometimes a patient has other medical problems, and if you're going to remove a big part of their kidney, they may not have enough kidney function to keep going. Or if a patient has heart disease, lung disease, they may not be good candidates for surgery, and in those situations, we tend not to do it. Sometimes it's more of a technical problem. The location of the tumor in the kidney may make it difficult for the surgeon to resect, and those are the perfect patients to present at our, or to discuss at our multidisciplinary committee, because then sometimes we give therapy by mouth or intravenously up front in order to shrink the kidney, the kidney tumor, and it makes it much easier for the surgeon then afterwards to resect that tumor.
Now, Is there ever any need for dialysis for patients who have kidney cancer and undergo surgery? Or would someone, say, for instance, who has chronic renal failure and be receiving dialysis, would that be a contraindication for undergoing surgery?
No, we would still remove the kidney in a patient who's on dialysis. Certainly, if a patient's already on dialysis and they're not using the kidney and a tumor develops in that kidney, we might as well take the kidney out. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger problem is patients who are borderline for needing dialysis. And then if you remove a tumor and the area around the tumor, you might actually be removing enough of their healthy kidney to tip them over into needing dialysis. But it doesn't happen all that often that our surgeries really push someone over into dialysis.
Now, I guess, you know, one of the real advances that's been made for kidney cancer is in the treatment of advanced metastatic disease. So maybe you can take us through what has been developing over the last few years.
Yes, this is a very exciting time to be a kidney cancer oncologist. In the mid-1990s, the first drug was approved for kidney cancer, and that was interleukin-2. And that's very difficult therapy. Not everybody can tolerate it. The advantage of giving high-dose interleukin-2 is that there is a certain percentage of kidney cancer patients whose disease is actually cured by the interleukin-2, and the response rates are in the order of 20%. So, yes, it's not very high, but those responses tend to be very, very durable. So we like to do that as our first therapy. But until
so maybe, Harry, let me just hold you off there. So maybe you can just explain to our listeners, what is interleukin-2? Kind of sounds pretty fancy.
Yes, it is very fancy. It is a growth factor for a certain type of T cells, and so we're in essence activating the immune system to fight against the kidney cancer. We give it inpatient. There are a lot of side effects, and it's not easy to tolerate. But patients tend to get through it. We tend to push them very hard, even if they're not feeling well. But we hold their hands through the therapy, and as I said before, there is a subset that has a very prolonged response or remission after the interleukin-2. So we tend to try to do that. So that's an immune-based therapy.
Now, one of the things I have to say that I've been very impressed with the way that you folks have been giving the interleukin-2 is that you've modified the dose. And so while there are side effects associated, you know, I was actually at the National Cancer Institute where this interleukin-2 therapy was developed. And everyone needed to be in the intensive care unit to be carefully monitored, and everyone got really sick. And really, I think the way that you and your kidney cancer team have kind of modified, tweaked the dosing, really patients seem to tolerate it much, much better and seem to have as good or perhaps even a little bit better results.
That's correct. We give the interleukin-2 twice a day rather than three times a day. We give it on a regular floor. Patients are very carefully monitored. They're seen by a physician or a physician extender before every dose. We have been able to keep about 90% of the patients out of the intensive care unit with this fashion. There's a higher nursing to patient ratio, but not as high as in the intensive care unit. And our experience on the first patients treated, it's a few dozen patients, it appears to be as good as giving it three times a day.
Now, so what about these new target therapies that have been developed to treat kidney cancer?
For the patients who do not respond to interleukin-2 or are not candidates for interleukin-2, there are a number of new therapies that have been developed. So as of today, six drugs have been FDA approved in the last few years. I think the first one was FDA approved in late 2004 or 2005, and since then we've had another five. All of these drugs target what we call the vascular system or the vascular factory of the tumors. So these tumors need a lot of blood supply, and if you turn that off, it tends to sort of suffocate them and take away their nutrients, and then they can't grow that much. So the first drug to be approved was called sorafenib. The second one is called sunitinib, and then after that we had temsirolimus, then everolimus, then bevacizumab, and most recently we've had a drug called Votrient or Zapanib approved just a few days ago. So we now have a list or a whole armamentarium of drugs that we can use in this disease. None of them really appears to give us the kind of cures that we see with the immune-based therapies, but we can keep patients going for a long time. We have patients who had bad disease when we first met them, and they've been on these drugs. We just treat them sequentially with one drug after another, and we can keep them going for many years with these therapies. We tend to give them sequentially. There have been a number of studies where they use them together, and the toxicity, though, is quite prohibitive when we give them together. So we give them one after the other. Now, there are other drugs also being studied, which I'd like to mention, and some of them look very promising. There are a number of immune-based targeted therapies. We have a study that Dr. Schnoll is leading at Yale with an antibody to one of the molecules that essentially puts the brakes on the immune system. So you give this and you activate the immune system. And that seems to be working very nicely in kidney cancer. We have other clinical trials
also. And what drug is that called, Harriet?
Well, it's an anti-PD-1 antibody. It's made by a company called Medarex. Then we have another clinical trial also of a molecule made by Medarex, and this is a very fancy immune stimulant sort of conjugated to a toxin. We've just started doing this trial, and so far patients are tolerating it well. It's a little early in the game to say whether it's working or not. But there are a number of other drugs that are being studied at other institutions, such as a drug called ipilimumab. It's a monoclonal antibody to a different molecule that puts brakes on the immune system, and that too has been proven to be effective in kidney cancer as well as in other diseases.
And are there any attempts to try to combine some of these different immune therapies to really try to maximize the immune-mediated effects?
Well, we will be getting there. We're starting to combine them in other diseases, but for kidney cancer, we're not that far down the road yet.
Mm-hmm. And how about any thoughts about, say, combining the immune therapies with these new targeted therapies? Is there any possibility that that might also work to kill the kidney cancers a little bit better?
There definitely is. I think that the first step would be to establish the other immune therapies, the other targeted immune therapies for kidney cancer, and then add other drugs. So again, we're not there yet for kidney cancer, but we will be getting there, I'm sure, down the road, because presumably if you target the immune system and the blood vessel manufacturing, you might not have overlying toxicities, and it may be easier to administer those drugs in combination rather than giving a combination of two drugs that target the same thing.
Now, I guess one of the advantages of these new target therapies is that some of them, or many of them, are actually oral. And so patients don't necessarily need to be admitted to the hospital or get intravenous injections.
Yes, that is an advantage, although we keep warning patients that just because something is given as a pill, it doesn't mean that it's better tolerated than something that's given intravenously. And in fact, our experience with the kidney cancer drugs is that the less toxic ones are the bevacizumab and the temsirolimus that are given intravenously, and perhaps the sunitinib, which is given by pill, is often not well tolerated. But all of this is individual, and there are patients who tolerate the pills very well and patients that don't.
So in closing, Harriet, we just have about 30 seconds left. Any messages that you'd like to give to our listeners out there this evening about kidney cancer?
Well, I would say that it's no longer a hopeless disease as it was 5 or 6 years ago when we only had one drug, the interleukin-2. We do have a lot to offer. I would suggest that they try some of these immune-based clinical trials as well, because those actually offer a lot of hope for more durable remissions.
Well, you've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank my guest this evening, Dr. Harriet Kluger, for discussing the treatment and detection of kidney cancer. From the Yale Cancer Center, this is Ed Chu, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have any questions or would like to share your comments, you can go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.